Erica, what if I told you the end is near? So near, in fact, that I can give you the date, July 29th.
That's next week, Dave. We have some work to do. We're Growth Busters, after all.
We are, and we'll explore that subject next on the Growth Busters podcast.
Calling, 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 calling. Call a Growth Buster. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Okay, well, you have entered the Growth Busters podcast about the joy of living sustainably. In fact, the absolute necessity of living sustainably. I'm your co-host, Dave Gardner, and I am joined, as always, by...
co-host Erica Arias.
Now, we teased everybody with this thought that the end is near, and so I'm sure that they're on pens and needles, but we're going to have to make them wait just a couple more minutes before we dig into the meat of this episode, because, as always, I want to share a little bit of listener feedback, and then I've got one quick little breaking news thing that I'd love to get your take on real quick. Are you cool with that?
I am cool with that.
Okay, great. Listener feedback. We've got a problem on the Growth Busters website, and you cannot post a comment on the website right now. We got some kind of a glitch developed, and we haven't had a chance to get that fixed yet. So I apologize. And I know that's the only reason we didn't get 100 comments on our last episode, the Overshoot playlist, the top 10 environmental songs of all time, because by every other method, we heard from lots of people.
Fair to say, I got a few emails myself, a lot of song recommendations, which was really exciting. So yay, thanks, listeners.
Yeah, so I'm really glad that that caught everyone's fancy. So thanks for listening to that episode. I think it's kind of a more fun than usual episode in some ways. And we have gotten lots of suggestions for songs that either maybe we overlooked and should have made the top 10 list, or at the very least should be added to a growing list. And in fact, Erica, I know you've put together a Spotify playlist and you've added the worthy nominations to that playlist, right?
I have. We are close to about, gosh, how many songs do we have? I can look that up right now. As of today, we have a total of 55 songs.
Wow.
What?
So that's great. What I think we ought to do is start planning another episode where we do a follow-up and we do a similar playlist, but let's do another one like that.
Let's do it.
Until we get the thing on the website fixed, you can comment on the Growth Busters podcast Facebook page, or the Growth Busters Facebook page, or Growth Busters Twitter. You can tweet us. You can email us podcast@growthbusters.org. So you have ways of finding us if you have something that you want to share. And we're getting quite a collection of those things. It'll take us a long time to catch up. Today, we've got kind of a long episode as it is, I think. So I'm just going to share one little bit of listener feedback. And interestingly, this came from a podcast app called Castbox. I haven't been using it, but I discovered that there is a desktop version. So I went on my laptop to check it out. And there's actually a place there for listeners to post comments about the episodes. And there was a comment that was made back in January. So interestingly, this is a little bit related to this whole end is near thing that I teased you with at the beginning. Episode 23 of the Growth Busters podcast was titled, What Do You Do When the End is Near? And Erica, I don't know if you remember, I'm pretty sure you did listen to that. It was before you joined as a co-host, but I had Madeline Somerville on with me. Madeline wrote the book, All You Need Is Less. And for about a year or two, she wrote this great column in the UK Guardian by the same name, All You Need Is Less. Very smart Canadian lady. And part of our conversation, Madeline and I talked a little bit about the ditching of the plastic straw. I don't really remember how that came up. Yeah. But anyway, so CJ wrote a comment that referred to that. So let me share that comment with you, Erica. CJ wrote, "She's right. Fussing with straws won't help. But the conundrum I feel is the one she brings up. Which future do we prepare for? I'm trying to have a foot in the normal society and a foot in the prepping for collapse. Just one little note is that often changing our energy wasting habits saves a lot of money too. So I'm going to start using my dryer much less. I don't buy drinks out, so I don't even need those straws, LOL. Thanks a lot, Dave."
Wow. Thanks, CJ.
It is true that ditching the straw isn't going to make us or break us on saving human civilization.
it'll bring us a little closer. Every little bit counts, right?
Every little bit helps. It's not like it takes a lot of effort, and it's not like it's going to ruin the global economy. Heaven forbid that we do that.
I think the problem really exists when people think, well, I'm saving straws, so now I can do whatever I want, and I can have 10 kids and eat meat every single day and drive 100 miles a day and just not care because you're saving straws.
So you're bringing up something that we've heard lately from somebody who's pretty smart, and I hear it from time to time. And I think we're going to do a whole episode about this whole moral license phenomenon, you know, this theory that if people put some energy into some of the simple things, they have nothing left. They have no focus left to put into the important stuff, or they kind of give themselves permission to not do the important stuff. I'm not sure I buy into that, Erica. I'm just not sure. Hot off the presses, World Resources Institute just released the results of a study. They were trying to figure out whether we could, by cutting beef consumption, feed a world of 10 billion people. That was kind of the mission of the study. And just came across my desk this morning via EcoWatch. So there's this piece, and we'll put a link in the show notes. So the headline is, "Cut Beef Consumption in Half to Help Save the Earth, Says New Study." Let me read to you the first paragraph. "The world's population will hit 10 billion in just 30 years, and all of those people need to eat. To feed that many humans with the resources Earth has, we will have to cut down the amount of beef we eat, according to a new report by the World Resources Institute." Erica, I wanted to bring that up because, one, I think very highly of the World Resources Institute to begin with. And, of course, they did not write this little news story. Someone, Jordan Davidson, wrote this news story at EcoWatch. And I have a little bit of a bone to pick with Jordan, because Jordan states that the world's population will hit 10 billion in just 30 years, as though that's a fact. And, that, you know, it is predicted by some that it will, but we do not know that. In fact, it is not necessarily our destiny.
Right. I've heard between 9 and 12 billion, and it's really hard to accurately assess how many we will be by that time.
Sure. But, the most official one is the most recent world population prospects that the UN just published in June. Puts that number at most likely to be at 10.9 billion. But my point is, we just don't know that. One thing we do know is we really don't want to go there. Okay?
No.
And we don't have to go there. That is not predestined. At this point, we could choose quite a different trajectory. So that bugs me that Jordan just stated that as fact. And then in the next paragraph, Jordan writes, "To feed a growing world, Americans will need to eat about 40% less beef, da 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 da. To feed a growing world." It's like,
that's inevitable. Like, we're not doing anything to address the fact that we're growing.
We got a growing world, so what can we do?
Yeah. Well, that's what humans do.
They do. And, I'm not arguing against cutting beef consumption. I have cut, in the last couple of years, I have cut way back from what I used to eat in the way of all kinds of meat.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting that he only spoke about reducing beef consumption, but not chicken or fish. And I think we have a lot of vegans out there, maybe vegetarians out there, that wouldn't be very happy about his focus on just cutting beef.
Yeah.
I enjoy meat, but 3 burgers a week on average is what he writes. And that's a little...
That's ridiculous. My aim is a burger a month is what I aim for.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I'm perfect. I mean, I'd be more perfect if I had 0 burgers a month. But the point I want to make is that, well, that's going to be difficult to get people around the world to cut back on their beef consumption. And I don't suggest that we not try. But you know what's even easier to do? And that is for people to choose to have fewer children. Just to say, let's not put heroic efforts into figuring out how to feed 10.9 billion. Let's not have 10.9 billion.
Is that really that easy, though, to convince people? You and I, for you and I.
Politically, yeah. Politically, it's not any easier than getting them to give up meat, apparently. But in the world of physics, it really isn't that hard. And in fact, the human race has demonstrated that we have this great ability to do that, because we've cut the global average fertility rate in half over the last 50 years. Meanwhile, voluntarily, we've done nothing about cutting back on our meat consumption.
Right.
So it just bugs me that Jordan, and I'm sure every other journalist that's writing today about that report, is going to treat $10.9 billion as a fait accompli. That's going to happen. What are we going to do? We have got to figure out a way to feed $10.9 billion. And, you know, a lot of the trouble that we got ourselves into today in the world of climate change, ocean dead zones, and a few other things is the way we modified agriculture to feed the $7.7 billion that we have today and to feed some of them very poorly. But the heroic efforts, the Green Revolution, created this modern industrial agriculture system that is wrecking the planet today. So we know that having fewer children doesn't wreck the planet.
Right.
There are no serious unintended consequences of that. So right. Just saying.
There was a mentioning of the 820 million starving people in the world. Well, that's going to change too. There's going to be much more. That's really not going to go anywhere. So... yeah.
Unless you ask an economist, they'll have a different opinion on that. So anyway, we'll put a link to that EcoWatch story, which will have links in turn to the report itself. And maybe one of these days I'll get around to reading it because I just think it's a distraction, you know? We probably need to do it, but there are some things that are more important for us to do, like get over our obsession with economic growth and to get over our fear and trepidation over talking about just having smaller families and admitting that the world's overpopulated and that we need to change that trajectory for sure.
Agreed.
Okay. Are you ready for the main event?
Yes, sir.
I know I scared you to death with July 29th being the end. Well, it's not the end of civilization, we don't think, but July 29th, 2019 is Earth Overshoot Day. And that's certainly not cause for celebration.
It's a sad day. It's arriving earlier and earlier every year, and we can actually do something about it, and we're not.
And that is the subject of this episode because we're releasing this shortly before July 29th, and we want you to know that July 29th is Earth Overshoot Day. We want you to know what that is. And so far, when we've gone out on the streets to talk to people and ask them questions and gauge their level of knowledge about this. Sadly, we have found that very, very few people have ever heard of Earth Overshoot Day, and almost as few have ever heard of Overshoot or understand what Overshoot is. So this episode, we're going to see if we can't change that a little bit. In order to do that, we're actually going to give the issue full exploration. If we're really lucky on Earth Overshoot Day, the mainstream media, some of them anyway, may give that subject a little bit of time. But I guarantee you, if they do, if we're lucky enough that they do report on it in the broadcast media or audio or video media, we're going to be lucky to get a 3 or 4 minute story about it. And in the print and online text world, where we might be lucky if we get a page about it. And it really deserves a lot more exploration. So Erica and Dave are going to do you the favor of giving you a deeper dive.
Yes. Let's get on with it.
All right. Let's do it. So first of all, what the hell is Overshoot?
Yeah. Overshoot, I guess in the simplest terms, is when the entire planet is consuming more resources than the world is able to replenish.
Overshoot is what happens when our ecological footprint exceeds the biocapacity of the planet. Your ecological footprint is what you consume and occupy on the planet in order to live. The demand that you make on the planet, that's your ecological footprint. Main consumption categories would be food, housing, mobility, goods, and services. And as it happens, food production, which we've been talking about, food production uses over half of our planet's biocapacity, by the way. But anyway, when you take a shower, drink a glass of water, when you eat your breakfast, when you get in the car and drive somewhere, when you get on an airplane and fly somewhere, when you get on the bus or the train, I mean, almost everything you do throughout your day, you are using planetary resources. Stop me if I'm wrong on this, Erica. Your share of all that you're using, that's all adds up to be part of your ecological footprint. And then there's another really important part of it, which is your waste. what you do when you go into the bathroom, your carbon emissions, you know, from burning fossil fuels, the carbon emissions from the manufacturer of that brand new refrigerator that you just put in your kitchen last week, the manufacturer of the car that you may have purchased, certainly the carbon emissions from burning fuel to move you around, the carbon emissions from heating or air conditioning your office and your house, all that stuff all adds up into your ecological footprint.
It is really expensive just being a human, isn't it, Dave?
We don't really think about it, but yeah, we're pretty hard on the planet. And so living sustainably really is all about balance. And so there were a couple of really smart guys back in the 90s. William Rees, who was a professor at the University of British Columbia, and Matis Wackernagel, who was a doctoral student working with Dr. Rees, they came up with this concept of ecological footprint. And they wrote a book about it. It's a good book. I think it was called Your Ecological Footprint, if I remember correctly. Everything I just told you was the stuff that they dreamed up. It's just a concept, an approach to analyzing how sustainably we're living.
Measuring.
Really. Yeah, measuring it, yeah, and analyzing it. Ecological footprint analysis. And Matis Wackernagel, being a really good student, apparently, eventually he decided that the world really needed to be looking at this, measuring this scientifically around the world, year in and year out. And in 2003, he founded the Global Footprint Network. And this organization has been doing that. They collect UN data, like 15,000 data points for every country, and they compute every year what the average ecological footprint is of the citizen in each country, what their average footprint is, and the biocapacity of each country, and come up with an average per person living in that country. And so each country every year gets a report card as to whether their citizens are living within the biocapacity of their country or overshooting it. And then also we get this global total, the global biocapacity and the global footprint of the human race. And that's the big thing. And that's what July 29th is all about, is that they have determined that this year, by July 29th, the total human race will have already burned through all of the resources that it takes the planet a year to regenerate.
Wow. It's really sad.
Did I leave anything out? Anything you want to clarify or add to that?
Yeah, I really appreciate the analogy that Matis uses, which is like just simple accounting principle, and how we are able to pay attention to that on a daily basis. You know how much money is in your bank. You know what you're spending. You know how much you need to spend to remain in budget. But we don't think about that in terms of the world or our own personal space being our bank. And it's not just my bank, but it's everybody's bank. What I use affects everybody else, and it works both ways. So I think that's a really important point to stress.
Yep. If you're listening and this is the first time you've really been exposed to this, you have a million questions, I'm sure. And most of your questions, I think, are going to get answered in this episode, but we'll have a lot of really useful links in the show notes to help you dive into this subject a little bit more deeply. So fear not. And Erica, you mentioned earlier that Earth Overshoot Day has been moving earlier and earlier every year. And of course, that's bad news, because if we were living in something approaching sustainable balance with the biocapacity of the planet, Earth Overshoot Day would be December 31st or maybe even January 1st of the next year. Instead, here we are in July now. And I think even more important than the actual day really is the trend. If the day was moving later each year, then we could probably pat ourselves on the back and say, we must be doing something right. Let's keep it up, whatever that is. But it's been going earlier. So back in 1970, by their calculations, Earth Overshoot Day was December 29th. We were almost in balance in 1970. That was about the year that we first crossed over that red line into overshoot. 10 years later, that date had moved earlier to November 4th. 10 years later, 1990, the date was October 11th. In 2000, it was September 23rd. In 2010, it was August 7th. And here we are, 2019, at July 29th. So the trend is not good, that's for sure.
Wow.
Now, let's just go to the conversation with Matas Wackernagel.
Yeah.
And get it straight from the horse's mouth.
Let's do it.
All right. It's really good to speak with you, Matas. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Let me first say about this new book, Ecological Footprint, Managing Our Biocapacity Budget. I think it's due out, what, September 3rd? Is that right?
That's correct. Just going to press.
I want to compliment you on that. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I predict this is really going to be a seminal work. This is going to be not just another book about the environmental crises that humankind has been creating, but it's going to go down in history along with Silent Spring, The Limits to Growth, probably William Catton's Overshoot. This is going to go down in history, I think, as one of the best books. I am really, really impressed with it, and I want to thank you for writing it.
Thank you very much. I had fun writing it.
Well, that's good. That always helps when it's fun. Global Footprint Network has been crunching UN data and reporting two things to us for many years now. You've been reporting national and global biocapacity, and then also the demands that we're putting on that biocapacity, our ecological footprint. Why should anyone care?
It's not two separate things. It's like when we account for money, we want to know how much we spend and how much we earn. If you just know one side, it's not that useful. You know, so comparing how much we use compared to how much we have, whether it's money or resources, is quite essential. We're in a silly situation where we think only money counts and physics doesn't count. That's a bit of a silly path we're on. But I think we're starting to recognize that using more resources than Earth can renew produces serious consequences. One very obvious one is CO2 accumulation in the atmosphere. And we can see how hard it is to turn the boat around. The accumulation is increasing still, because even the emissions are increasing still. And understanding how much we have compared to how much we use is therefore quite essential.
And maybe you can help answer this just for our listeners that don't know. Can you define what is overshoot?
Overshoot is when we use more from nature than nature can renew. And that has happened, I think, through human history, very much on a local basis. We overused one area and then we moved on. What's new today is that we do it on a global basis. So if we kind of calculate, we calculate the human demand, humanity's demand on all ecosystems and compare it with what Earth can renew. It's for the first time in human history, the last 40 years, that we have been using more than what Earth can renew. And that's possible for some time, like local overshoot is possible for some time, but you start to deplete the underlying strength of nature, and nature will be able to produce less, and your demand is higher, and eventually the physical constraints will force us to kind of consume less as a whole. So overshoot will end whether we like it or not. And the big question is whether we do it by design or disaster. We can choose ourselves, or we will be told how to do it, told by nature.
So just to clarify, so you what you're saying is we've been in overshoot for the past 40 years.
Correct. Even more than 40 years now. Yeah, the early 70s when we started to enter overshoot. And it's something that you don't feel directly. It's like with your bank account. I mean, your ATM machine doesn't tell you, oh, you took out more than you put in. You know, you can, as long as you have assets that you can deplete, you can take out more. And so if you don't have accounts, it doesn't tell you to what extent financially you're in a positive situation. And the same thing is true for resources. If you don't have accounts, we don't see immediately to what extent we are taking more than what we regenerate. Think of a forest. A forest has huge stocks of trees, and what we take out in a year is much, much less than the stock that is standing in the forest. So we can, for quite a long time, deplete the forest more than what it regenerates. But if we have a good forester that keeps account and says how many trees are actually growing, are they growing at the same rate as we are depleting the forest, then we can manage the forest sustainably.
Now, some people might have a hard time just buying this, that we could be in overshoot for close to 50 years, and yet you turn on the faucet, water comes out, you go to the grocery store, there's food on the shelves. How can we go so long without disaster?
Many listeners may have heard of Earth Overshoot Day. We mark every year the day when humanity has used, from January 1st to that date, as much as Earth can renew in the entire year. This year it falls on July 29th. Last year it was August 1st. So the date is coming still earlier and earlier every year. And so radio hosts have said, okay, you said it was overshoot yesterday. I opened my fridge and there was still beer in my fridge. How is that possible? And it's like with money too. I mean, we can spend more than what we earn for some time as long as we have assets or we can go into debt. And that's what we are doing. So we are not running into like fixed walls. It's possible to overuse, to overfish, to overharvest forests, to overpump CO2 in the atmosphere, to overdeplete fresh water, to deplete soils for some time, but not forever.
Do you happen to know who first coined the term overshoot?
I don't know. What I know is that it's not very much used. I mean, overshoot is used in a number of different disciplines. Ecologists probably have used it, I may think, for 100 years or so. It became more popular with the book Limits to Growth that came out in 1972. And then Catton, as you mentioned as well, Catton wrote a very interesting book I think the first sociologist who recognized the implications of resource overuse for the human civilization in a quite profound way. But it's still not a very well understood concept. I mean, the strange thing is it's a hard word to translate in other languages. We operate in many different languages, and most languages don't even have a word for it. It's like if you had a disease and the doctor doesn't even know the name of a disease, let alone a therapy. That's kind of silly, particularly considering how deep we are in overshoot. So it's a concept. That's why, I mean, also biocapacity, overshoot, etc. It's similar to kind of helping people to understand gravity. You know, gravity, whether you like it or not, is just there. Understanding it helps architects build better buildings. If you don't understand gravity, the bridges are not that strong. You know, they don't last that long. It's still hard to go up the hill. Even if you know gravity, it doesn't change it, but you understand why. And so the same way, I think understanding biocapacity, how much Earth can renew and to what extent we can overshoot and how we need to operate, it's not a directive. It's a tool to help us better contextualize our lives.
So pretty widely understood by ecologists and maybe physicists, but not by political leaders, journalists, everyday people?
I mean, one tragedy is that, particularly in the West, most of the governments are run by people from social sciences, like lawyers, economists, and particularly, I would say, since World War II, the social sciences have been quite devoid of physical concepts. We can go into why that's the case, but so we operate as if there was no time or space or matter in those theories, and so I think their familiarity with physical concepts is not particularly strong.
Is that one of the things you're trying to change with Earth Overshoot Day?
Absolutely. I think that's one of my proudest pieces of work that we do, and I can be proud of it because it wasn't my invention. A friend of ours, Andrew Sims, came up with the idea of let's mark it as Earth Overshoot Day because that's understandable. And what I'm particularly proud about is that we can explain something quite sophisticated in simple two-syllable words that everybody can understand, no big concepts. We don't even have to say ecological footprint or biocapacity. You can say between, actually there's one three-syllable word that most people understand, January. You know, so between January 1st and July 29th, people have used as much as Earth can renew in the entire year. So the only three-syllable word was January. Pretty simple. And it gives you also a clear quantitative understanding. People understand kind of, oh yeah, how many days are in a year, and is July 29th early in the year or late in the year? Would September be better than July? You know, so it makes it understandable in a way that probably 2 degrees Celsius or 350 ppm or whatever we use as measures may not translate as well.
That's true, too. Because I am a fan, I definitely want to try to anticipate the critiques that we might get. But you've been around that block a time or two. So I want to ask you about whether your ecological footprint accounting that comes up with this date, would you characterize it as pretty conservative?
I would say it's quite robust. We are kind of jokingly saying what we're doing is totally pedestrian science, because what we do is even more simple than financial accounting. When you do financial accounting, it's actually not that simple, because you need to understand the difference between, for example, revenue and profit in a company. You know, it's, you have to account that differently. So the physical accounting we do is really straightforward. It's quite a simple assumption. We believe that the most limiting material factor that humanity is facing is the Earth's ability to renew. It's more limiting than how much fossil fuel we have on the ground, because what we're starting to realize is that we have a lot of fossil fuel on the ground compared to what the biosphere can take up from the CO2 emissions. Also, minerals and metals are pretty plentiful compared to the energy it takes to concentrate them and dig deeper holes and mining deeper, etc. So ultimately, the most limiting factor is what Earth can renew. So by mapping all the physical activities on that renewal, we get a sense of what the physical limitations are for humanity. And now how we do that, as I said, is super pedestrians. Basically, every tomato you eat, it takes space to produce a tomato. And when a tomato is produced, you cannot at the same time produce a potato or cotton or put a cow or build a house, etc. So all the activities that compete for ecologically productive space, we can add up. That's as simple as it is. Now, the complication comes from having all the data available around the world. And we limit ourselves strictly to UN data just to say, okay, if the UN was right, how much would we take compared to what Earth can renew? And even though we use about 15,000 data points per country and year to measure the ecological footprint or the demand on the biosphere, there's a lot of indication that what we calculate is quite conservative, both on a demand side, because not all consumption is adequately represented. You know, it's easier to kind of leave something out, or so it's not everything is included that puts a competing demand on the biosphere. And on the regeneration side, I think we exaggerate through UN data how productive Earth is, because we don't include depletion of soil or depletion of water because there's not good data available. So we assume that, for example, current agricultural yields can be maintained in the long run. And that's also a heroic assumption, because we boost productivity right now through fertilizers and through water pumping, etc. So to what extent in the long run we are able to maintain these high yields, I don't know, and nobody fully knows. You know, so we can pretty much say we are on the conservative side. Sometimes we say jokingly, you know, we're more concerned about our reputation than humanity's survival. So I want to make sure we don't exaggerate where we're at. And still currently, I think we can document for the year 2019 that the demand that humanity puts on the planet is about 75% higher than what Earth can renew. And that translates in saying we live like as if we had 1.75 Earth, which we don't have. And even using a full Earth just for humanity may not be ideal. You know, better than using 1.75, but E.O. Wilson, for example, now professor emeritus from Harvard, he's a driver in the biodiversity debate. Now, he just turned 90 a month ago. He suggests, let's use half of the planet. Because if you used half of the planet, there's a good chance that we can maintain about 85% of biodiversity. That's by using half of a planet, but now humanity uses 1.75.
So, damn, if anything, the news is worse than you're telling us.
We're trying to say it's not good news or bad news. It's just what it is, you know, like in some ways, that's kind of the context. The bad news is we don't react. That's kind of the bad news, because we could react. It's quite possible to turn things around. I mean, not overnight, and there are no big magical solutions, obviously, but the technology exists. Financial viability exists, you know, options exist to organize ourselves quite differently, just that we don't take advantage of them. That's the tragedy.
Erica, it's pretty funny. And in fact, Matas, you may not hear as much from Erica as I expected, because you're answering all of her questions. You're anticipating her questions. So, Erica, you just feel free to wave if you need to get a word in edgewise. But, it seems like we're well down the list already.
Sorry about that.
I really enjoyed reading the book and just listening to you. So I'm just in awe. But I guess it's very clear we've been operating in ecological deficit year after year. We've been doing it for over 40 or 50 years. And so you kind of already answered what the worry is in brief, but how are we managing to do this? Mm-hmm. That's kind of the puzzle.
Maybe it's a bit too complicated of a distinction, but at the world level, we run overshoot, you know, because the world doesn't trade with any other planet yet. So whatever we could produce, that's what we consume, or whatever we consume has to be produced. For countries, it's quite different. I come from Switzerland. I grew up in Switzerland. So obviously the trade flows are very, very large. So what you consume in Switzerland doesn't necessarily have to be produced in Switzerland. So with countries, we can compare how much do they use compared to what their own ecosystems can renew. In Switzerland, Switzerland uses now about 4.5 Switzerlands. And it does do that without overusing its own ecosystems. So it's not an ecological overshoot locally, but it has a huge demand on the rest of the world. How is that possible? Through three ways. As I said, one, it's possible to use more than what you have locally by overusing, which Switzerland is not doing. Mm-hmm. The second one is you can net import. So for example, Switzerland can export expensive watches and financial services and import oranges and potatoes and grains, etc. So we can have a physical imbalance of trade. And the third one is we can access the global commons for free. So for example, we can use international waters for fishing. We can emit CO2 to the atmosphere. And so it's by using the global commons without compensating anybody. And so these three mechanisms allow Switzerland to use 4.5 times more than what they have available. And because the Swiss economy has high income, we live in the illusion that we forever can buy the extra amount from somewhere else. Now the point comes, and that's kind of, I think, the most critical number I may tell today, is that currently 70% of the world population live in countries that have two conditions. One is they run an ecological deficit, which is possible to do for some time, also through depletion, and you can overuse. So 70% live A, in countries that have an ecological deficit, and B, their income is less than world average. Now, if everybody doubled their world income, that wouldn't change the ratio either, because it's a relative question, you know. If not everybody can be above average. Apparently, that's what we learn in school. So 70% of the world population, which is a very significant, strong majority, lives in countries that has a deficit and doesn't have the money to buy themselves out of the squeeze. And that points to a very brutal contradiction, and I think that is not appreciated enough. So when we look at, for example, I mean, the World Bank, they have as their slogan, ending poverty, which is wonderful that they want to do that. Now, ending poverty is not possible without resource security. So just by focusing on economic expansion without having the resource security to feed the machinery is what medical doctors would call palliative. It's just kind of, it may kind of help us to deplete a little faster in the short run, but not really enable us to be healthy in the long run.
Now, if we just keep on with business as usual, then at some point, would it be true then that because there's going to be so much competition for resources from the rest of the world, that at some point Switzerland would no longer be able to import to make up for its ecological deficit?
I think it's a possibility, and it's a possibility that the Ministry of Environment in Switzerland, they think sometimes about it, but the Ministry of Finance thinks it's absolutely irrelevant. And I don't understand why. I mean, I haven't heard a good argument yet. Why? And it's particularly surprising because Switzerland was very lucky in World War II in the sense that we weren't involved in direct war. We were surrounded by war. Switzerland was neutral and was able to maintain its integrity during the World War. And probably physically the most memorable part for Switzerland was that there was not enough food. So Switzerland could produce about I think, 6 or 7 months worth of food, and then they could stretch it by eating a little bit less and by having some victory gardens, you know, type. But then they also had to build a maritime fleet to bring food from the outside to Switzerland during World War II. Not an easy deed. And so my parents and my grandparents told me endless stories about this situation. So Switzerland experienced physically what it means not to have enough access to resources. And it's like forgotten right now. It could never happen again. So it's very surprising to me.
One of your charts that I think is just most informative, and it shows that we, by your calculations, the world went into overshoot, what, in 1970, I think.
Yeah.
But it also shows the world's biocapacity slowly increasing. I think you've said that it has increased maybe about 20% over
correct.
The years. Now, I would think eventually, if we really are in overshoot, that we would be damaging our ecosystems, and eventually that biocapacity would start shrinking. Do you expect that?
One of the beauties and also one of the dangers of nature is that it's so incredibly generous and robust. So the biosphere is able to kind of cope with stress quite amazingly well, which is, of course, wonderful in the short run, but it also hides some of the damages that we leave. So, for example, one big driver of overuse is the CO2 emissions. So, and the effect of CO2 emissions come very, very slowly compared to, you know, human lives. And so, even though the accumulation of CO2 in the atmosphere has been quite significant, the impact on reduced productivity hasn't been that strong yet. We see some impacts, like, for example, I live in California. Most likely, the increase of forest fires is part of that, or we see the pine beetles in Canada, for example, kind of slightly shifting ecosystems, making the winters less severe, and then pests take over more. So there are some indications of obviously coral reefs not being as productive. So there are some indications of productivity loss, but overall, since agriculture is still increasing in intensification, the biocapacity still seems to be going up. So we see all these kind of different trends. I mean, the long run or longer run, I mean, if we really move to a world with much more severe climate impact, there's quite a high likelihood that the productivity of agriculture will not be as high in let's say, 100 years from now than it is right now. And we are expecting a much higher population. So the squeezes are inevitable.
Yeah. I guess related to this, how would you say policymakers are paying attention to all of these signs of shrinking or diminishing biocapacity?
I mean, there are all kinds of policymakers. Some pay a lot of attention and some much less. I mean, you have probably heard 2 weeks ago the Pope invited all the, these are not policymakers, but CEOs of oil companies to come to the Vatican and talk about how we need to decarbonize. And then even CEOs from BP and others, it's staggering how CO2 emissions still go up. I mean, so it's kind of an interesting conversation that you wouldn't have expected even 10 years ago that the Pope invites a CEO, CEOs of major oil companies and investment funds to really look at this issue. I mean, that's an indication. I mean, China, for example, we always think it's their political system. It's more, I think, that the Chinese elite, more of them are engineers or physically trained scientists, appreciate physics a little bit more than the West, and they just recognize that their resource demand compared to what they have available themselves is out of balance, and they react in two ways. One is to say we need to build more roads and train lines to get resources to us, but they also recognize the world is too small overall, and so the second thing is that they have what they call ecological civilization, the recognition that somehow in the end, like there needs to be, nature is a kind of a limiting factor, they call it balance, harmony with nature, that we need to build a civilization that can live within the means of what nature can supply. So they recognize that. How aggressively are they implementing it? It's hard to say from the outside, but what is quite stunning is that China has about doubled its resource demand over the last 15 years in total and nearly per capita, because per capita is not going up so much, capita is not going up so much. That's quite stunning. And what's even more stunning is that in the last 3-4 years, they started to plateau. like from a very rapid upswing, they start to plateau. And I think it's not just economic downturn, because they still have relatively rapid expansion economically, but they start to realize that they have to get on a different track. So China is one example. Is that enough? I'm not sure. I think they would have probably to act much, much more rapidly. Now it takes, I think it's over 3.5 Chinas to support China. That's about the ratio.
Wow.
3.7, I think, is the number. 3.7 Chinas it takes to support China. And China is about a quarter of the world population. So so it's still at a ratio that is not sustainable, obviously. But they're discussing it actively. And it's surprising how little attention we pay. I mean, it's what is funny. Two countries I know of, and there may be more, have a ministry that's called Ministry of Transition. And these were formerly the environment ministries of Spain and of France. But I would say I want the ministries of environment to be called ministries of continuity, not of transition. I want the finance ministries to be called ministry of transition. Then I believe it, you know. But if we call the environment ministries ministry of transition and the others we keep on track, it's not a good sign.
What do you think is the biggest hurdle in our path, keeping us from becoming this sustainable society over the long haul?
It's a good question. And I think the biggest hurdle is that we don't ask ourselves what the biggest hurdle is, even academically. So we all get in our soapbox and tell about our solutions, and they don't really relate to what the biggest hurdle might be. And I think that our research programs should go a bit further and kind of find out more deliberately what these biggest hurdles might be, you know, and really test these hypotheses. Now, my hypothesis at this point is that particularly people with decision power don't believe that resolving the overshoot problem has anything to do with their own success. That their own success does not depend on resolving this problem. They don't have skin in the game, they believe. And that's so interesting how this is shifting, that suddenly I think with new voices, particularly the younger voices, often kind of associated with Greta Thunberg from Sweden, she speaks from a skin in the game perspective. You know, it's a totally different language. She says, "You are wrecking my life. I don't expect anything from you old people because you haven't done anything. And the fact that you're listening to me just tells me that you're totally out to lunch, because you should listen to the scientists. Why are you listening to a 16-year-old girl who knows nothing comparatively? That just shows how lost we are. I don't trust you." You know, so it's got a different language that evokes the idea of skin in the game. And I just had a chat with a friend of mine in Switzerland. He went to a confirmation party. So confirmation in the Protestant church means like at 16, you reconfirm that you want to be part of the church. And so they celebrate these young people. And so what was the big topic that came up? It was all about climate change for the young people and for the minister. And what the minister said, my friend was just shaking his head. Said, oh my God, like these old people, they don't get it. And all the young people, they were so clear. They knew it has to happen. They said, yeah, I don't eat sausages anymore, you know, because it's not so good. But it's not about individual action. We have to have policy shifts. That's what the young people say, the 16-year-olds and the old folks that do, oh my God, it's too complicated. We don't understand. So I think the key really is to bring it down to one concept. We lack the sense of skin in the game.
It's a good answer, I think.
Agree. Yeah. Yeah. Would you say the data suggests we need to be making awful sacrifices, or is it suggesting that we actually have an opportunity to turn things around?
Both. No. No, I mean, in some ways, the biggest sacrifices will come if we don't turn things around. I mean, I'm just taking Oakland as an example, because it's a progressive city. It was led by Jerry Brown earlier, who had the idea of vertical suburbs rather than horizontal suburbs, and we are starting to see the impact of his vision fold out. And we have a very progressive mayor as well, progressive council, all progressive, wonderful. And still, even a progressive city like Oakland continues to rebuild the past. So we built huge buildings that are enormously fossil fuel dependent, focused on car transportation, even though they're close to public transportation. So we continue to destroy ourselves. So people in Oakland say, oh, hooray, we have a progressive city government. And nobody feels, oh my God, we're destroying our own city by adding assets to our city that will, in the end, hurt us. They will not be valuable in the future, and they will lose in value at the time when the economy is weak. And I'm just using Oakland because it's probably one of the more progressive cities that tries to do things right, you know? And so in some level, to be provocative, I'm quite happy that Ms. Pelosi and Mr. Trump are not able to get along, because both have a view of building infrastructure that is just extending the 1950s, to put them on steroids, you know, to kind of extend the highways, to rebuild the bridges, rather than to build the economy that we need. And so not even the opposition here, or the kind of the broader view, has an idea of what we actually need to be successful. And we don't understand that sustainability and success is the same word.
That's one of the greatest takeaways from that book, I think, this new book. And in fact, it makes me want to give a copy to, you know, not just members of Congress and the Senate, but to the local city council members and county commissioners. You do a wonderful job of talking to the people who are making the decisions on the ground about what kind of infrastructure investments might be made.
It's the strangest thing. We worked for some years with the financial industry, and then we realized they're very slow as well, so we ran out of steam a little bit. And the strangest thing I heard from the finance industry is the following. Over and over again around the world, they said, oh yeah, these issues like overshoot, they're just so slow, you know. We'll just then get out when it gets bad, which is so strange, because on average, nobody can get out. You can only get out of the market if somebody else buys your assets. Otherwise, you cannot get out. And then somebody else has the risk. So as society, somehow, somewhere, somebody will get the haircut. So either if the finance industry is so sure they can get out, and somehow they can socialize the losses, then we have a huge kind of regulatory problem, you know, that something is systemically off track. Or they live in delusion because, as I said, you can't beat math that easily. So it has surprised me, and I've never got a good answer.
Quite a story. It makes me want to ask you where your investments are.
I can talk about that as well. In the end, I mean, it's. I just saw the news, Time magazine, with an interview with our president. Says, my life is a bet. And I think in some ways, my life too, it's about betting. It's not about believing. It's not about religion, kind of saying, okay, do you believe in climate change or not? But understanding our physical context just gives us much more insight in which assets may gain in value and which ones won't in the long run, which make us more robust than not. And it applies pretty straightforward. I mean, the question that we will have to move to a regenerative economy is an obvious one. It's not even a question. There's no way out. Even if we want to burn every last liter of petrol, you know, in the end, we'll have to be a regenerative future. The only question is how quickly we want to get there. If we opt to go slowly, we will wreck so much of our biocapacity that the budget left in the end will be very, very slim. If we act faster, it may be more painful in the short run, we may think, but the budget left over will be just dramatically larger, you know. So it's up to us to choose how we want to invest. So there's a predictable future, and given that predictable future, you can then look at your asset base and say, okay, to what extent will my assets work well in this kind of a future, and or won't work well? So it's not that complicated in the end.
Wow. Couldn't have said it better myself, obviously, but that's why I'm me and you're you. We try to talk a lot on the Growth Busters podcast about ways that we can change our own individual behavior. And I happen to think it's important, but I want to give you a chance to tell me I'm full of baloney.
You're full of baloney.
Does individual action make a difference at all?
In the end, it's all about individual actions. But if we think we can shift the world by enticing people to behavior change, I think there's actually this strange paradox that we have encountered over the last years, and there's now more and more psychological research showing it. Like, if we force people to kind of moral suasion to kind of do the right thing, there's this funny phenomenon happening that is similar to the rebound effect. I don't know if you're familiar with the rebound effect. Let me perhaps start with the rebound effect. That's kind of what people can imagine.
Yeah.
An economist called Jevons in 1865 had to make some money and write a book. And he wrote it about the coal question, recognizing that the UK was using coal at a rate that he thought would not be able to be sustained. And what he said in the book was quite interesting. He said, "It's a confusion of ideas to believe that more efficient machines will reduce our resource consumption, because the more efficient machines become, the more they will be used and the more the aggregate demand will be. Like in the beginning, we had steam engines. They could just be used as close to the mine because they were so inefficient, but they could pump the water out of the mine, and then the steam machines would get more efficient. You could put them on a train, you could make a locomotive, and then the steam machines would get even more efficient. Finally, we could have planes, we could have jets on the plane. So that usability of fossil fuels increases over time. So it's kind of this kind of the rebound effect, that the efficiency gains, if not somehow taxed away or redirected, tend to increase our ability to do things. And there's a similar phenomenon with individual action. It's called moral licensing. The idea that if we kind of try to do something good, like, okay, let's save a little bit of water when I brush my teeth, it takes so much mind space that then we're not as good at saving electricity or looking after our waste. If we do it just from a perspective of, oh, I can only do so much good, that's my budget for doing good. And so focusing, kind of trying to convince people to be kind of to work hard on something that they don't really kind of fully believe themselves, you can only get so far. So there's kind of the contradiction that it actually, psychological research shows it could be like a vaccination effect, that by forcing people to do something, they lose the bigger picture. So I think that the pathway that we need to go is quite a different one. We need first to fall in love with the future we want. And then once that love is part of our identity, we act quite obviously in that direction. You know, identity is a big driver. It can be used for good or bad. But for example, as a parent, an identity as a parent, any parent would say, I don't sell my child. You know, that's just, it's not a cost benefit question. Oh, how much would I sell my child? It's just kind of clearly like, oh, as a parent, I even help other parents, you know, so identity is a very strong force. So if our identity tells us, oh, clearly I'm a planeteer. I mean, I live on this planet. Clearly, I to be successful, I want sustainability, obviously, then all the actions fall in place much, much more easily. You know, like, for example, I bicycle to work, and I would do it even if it took more resources because I love it, you know? So it has to be built into your life in a way that is just, it's the new normal. That's just what it is. And then you don't think about it. If you have to think about every little action, there's only so much brain power we have. I don't know, you know, Kahneman's book, Thinking Slow, Thinking Fast. And so it's basically translating sustainability into thinking fast. Our brain, our reptilian brain thinks about 10,000 times faster than our kind of higher cognition. So as long as our reptilian brain doesn't understand sustainability deeply, and that's all trained, it's not a DNA question, it's all trained, we're not moving. I see that with ministers, for example. If a minister hears, if she hears that unemployment is up, you see her kind of profusely sweat. I mean, there's like sweat stains in her clothes and coming down her forehead. And I mean, unemployment is up. Oh my God. I mean, she cannot sleep. I mean, she turns and tosses in her bed. You know, so I mean, there's like a physical reaction. If you say your country uses four times more than what your country regenerates, you know, so what?
No sweat.
And that's now. And it could be as sweat inducing if we understood the implications. It's just that the translation from thinking slow to thinking fast hasn't happened. And we're sending students to schools. I think if I could accuse one part of sector of society most, it's probably the academic sector. How we under prepare people today for what's going to come. It's ridiculous. People born after 1985 will be under 65 in 2050. Anybody can calculate that. And according to Paris, for example, we have to be out of fossil fuel use way before 2050. I mean, during their work time, they have to lead a transition more rapid, more profound than the iPhone was for the phones, but that for the entire economy. You know, so that's kind of what we need to do. And they're utterly, utterly unprepared. And that's what I see. Even if I talk to students of environmental science, the level of understanding they have of how transition needs to happen, how quickly, what they can do, what the opportunities are, is stunning to me.
Well, that makes me very excited about what we're going to talk about during the next 2 hours, Martha.
Yeah.
Man, and that was a really nice way to tell me I'm full of baloney, too. So. I know we've kept you over. Erica, any last...
No, that's good. We haven't even started, I think.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I guess, yeah. I mean, I am one of those people born after 1985, so that's very concerning to me, but I feel so privileged to be having this interview with you, Mathis, and thank you for taking the time to speak with Dave and I. I guess 2050 comes around, we are expecting to be at over 9 billion. I think about that a lot. And I guess just last thoughts on how do we approach this concept of growing population and how do we really shrink our ecological footprints? And
wonderful. Yeah. It's a very good question. What are the options? We categorize options into five big areas because we have five fingers. And like a thumb, there's like one that goes in a different direction. So the thumb, to start with that, is how to help Earth to be healthy. Like that means kind of regenerative practices in agriculture and conservation, etc. And four, on the demand side, how do we build our cities? Because the way we build them, that defines how we live. How do we power them? How much energy it takes to run them, but also how we generate power. Do we use coal or solar? The third one is how do we feed ourselves? Now, food production uses about half of the planet's biocapacity. And then the fourth one is the one you mentioned, is how many are we? If we are doubled as many, you can calculate quite easily there would only be half as much planet per person, you know, so it's kind of not so complicated either. Over the long haul, I mean, when we look back even 60 years, the biggest, most significant factor of all has been how many people we are overall. So it doesn't make big changes from 1 year to the next, but in a cumulative way, it has a very, very big weight. Now, the good news is that looking at the demographic side, we know how to shift those tendencies. It's not done through control. That actually backfires. It's done by empowering women, by making opportunities better for women, equal rights for everybody, access to family planning. There's still, I hear in the United States, half of the pregnancies still are a surprise, sometimes a positive, sometimes a negative, but half the pregnancies are still a surprise to people. And so there's a big choice. And we just did a big calculation. I mean, there's some other factors that play a role, but we just did a rough calculation looking at demographic trends right now. If today we adopted fertility rates of Spain, Portugal, or Italy today, we would be back to 4 billion people by the end of the century. And I've been to Spain and Portugal and Italy, and you still see children play in the street. It's quite pleasant places. And then there's nobody telling them to have small families. It just happens that way. So it's not like any control mechanism. Actually, they try to increase the population size and they're not able to. But anyhow, so if that was replicated worldwide, we would have less than 4 billion people by the end of the century, which would give much more budgets for paying for education and healthcare, etc., for young people, give young people a much, much better opportunity for the future. Reversely, I think the just median run goes to 11 billion, you know? And the upper run, I think, goes to 16 billion and even still assumes a slight decline in fertility. We have seen declines in fertility. It's not that we haven't seen progress, but the decline has been far, far too slow. And so we underestimate the significance of the demographic transitions. And it's not so much, I mean, it's the tragedy for them, for the populations themselves. Like in Africa, there were about 150 million people at the turn of 1900, I think, roughly. Then now about a billion, and projected to be about 4 billion billion. I don't know how that's physically possible by the end of this century.
Yeah.
And that's just, the misery that we'll generate for people locally is just, it's not about a blame game. It's really about if we feel compassion and love for the next generation, if we want our children to have great lives. I mean, investing in women and equal rights and making sure family planning is available is just fundamental. And if you look, even in international development budgets, how little is spent on women empowerment and family planning and these aspects, it's staggering how little it is and how we ignore these trends because we think it's so difficult to talk about and then by not talking about it, we just kind of leave it to racist conversations. It's not about racism. It's about love for the next generation.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your time and this great book. We'll include a link in the show notes for Ecological Footprint. You can go pre-order the book today. I know if you're listening to this, you can't wait to get the book.
Thank you, Dave and Erica. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Manas.
Okay, Erica, what struck you as really important and memorable from that conversation? What's your takeaway?
70% of the world's people are living in poverty. And it's not necessarily us in the United States. In fact, living in I want to stay away from saying developed. I think in the book he talks about just distinguishing between developed and developing, that is like not descriptive and it's not really helpful to differentiate countries in that way. But I think just living in the US, I'll use us as an example, but just living in the US sort of shields us from really experiencing the effects of overshoot. And so when we talk about things like ecological footprint and living more sustainably, I think a lot of people already think that they are because they don't see all of the effects, economic breakdown, poverty, severe climate change in the way that a lot of other nations around the world do experience on a daily basis.
Yeah, they open their refrigerator and there's beer in there.
Right.
As we talked about, yeah.
So I get that all the time. Well, there's really nothing wrong, Erica. Why are you so angry about this? Or why are you so concerned? Well, because it matters. I don't know how else to say it. And I think that's sort of another thing is that we can present people with all this data and statistics and even go as far as like showing pictures. Like I think people are just visual and showing them pictures of, you know, underdeserved nations around the world. But I don't think it really hits people, unfortunately, until it is directly affecting them. And I think another part of the book that Mathis brings up is that the inconvenient truth and how that was just sort of a mistake in discussing climate because people don't think that it's their own personal problem. They look at it as something, this is not affecting me personally, it's affecting other people, so I'm not going to really take responsibility or care about this. But he thankfully says, no, this is something that equally affects all of us on this planet. This is our home. I think those were the major takeaways from the book and the conversation.
I felt a little bit guilty that I didn't follow up on something that he mentioned, what might be the most critical number that he would give us today. And, you know, we just had so many questions we wanted to ask of him. I just moved on to the next question. And this was where he told us that 70% of the world's people today live in countries that are both in ecological deficit and have income below the world average. They don't have the money to buy themselves out of the squeeze, he said. I've been thinking about that a little bit. And it's interesting that Africa is, just as continents go, it's the poorest continent. And yet most African nations are in ecological deficit today. And there's two things we know. One is that the people of Africa want to live better lives, and they certainly, I think, are entitled to. Number two, the African continent is expected to add 2 billion people to its population the rest of this century. And if they're already in ecological deficit, that tells me, one, wow, it's pretty unlikely that you're going to be able to add those people. If you add those people, we're going to have, you know, a big farm aid concert every day, 365 days a year, to raise the money to put food on ships to send to Africa. And we're not going to have the money or the food to do that. I mean, it's just our future world isn't a world where we have that luxury like we've seen in the past. We cannot just be Good Samaritans and find a way to feed an extra 2 billion people on the continent of Africa. Right. It's not going to happen. And just the idea of if all the people living on the continent of Africa, if we could snap our fingers and tomorrow they could live the lifestyle that you or I are living today in the United States, Erica, well, there would be game over there too, because the continent couldn't support that. It can't support the number of people on the continent today living the pretty impoverished lifestyles they are now. So, you know, we didn't really follow up with that. So I felt like at the very least, I wanted to kind of highlight that and accentuate that and make sure that no one missed that message. One other thing that I thought was pretty interesting, and that was that Matis was pretty clearly unimpressed with bureaucrats. I don't think you were surprised. I wasn't surprised. But it was kind of fun to hear him articulate that. And in fact, he had a really great line. He said, most governments are run by people in the social sciences, so we operate as if there is no time or space or matter. You know, in the U.S. today, we do that on steroids, but it's kind of interesting. It's true that, you know, it's really challenging to get bureaucrats to put the priority where it really needs to be about getting back into sustainable balance.
Yeah, you would think by now they would be working together to come up with more better solutions. But yeah, that was pretty funny. I'm glad that he said that.
Yeah. I'll opinionate here. I think a big part of the problem is that we have this global addiction and obsession with economic growth. So, you know, our allegiance to economic growth stands in the way of us doing what science tells us to do, which is that we really ought to be slimming down our ecological footprint.
Right.
But everybody's got their eye on GDP and how fast GDP is growing. Well, that, you know, living sustainably does not boost your GDP.
No.
Let's be honest, it doesn't.
And
but that's okay.
Well, part of the problem too is people don't think about success as equating to sustainability, and it is. It's the same thing.
So yeah, that was a good
when
point.
You hear somebody say, well, my goal in life is to secure the best paying job so that I can purchase the biggest house, so that I can afford my 5 children, so that I can afford my cars and all these riches, that somehow socially became the expectation for us to achieve success in today's world. And it's not sustainable. If that was everybody's perception of what success is defined as, then we would see Earth Overshoot Day coming a lot sooner than July 29th.
And one of the things I think Matis said in relation to that, when we were talking about that, he said, we need to fall in love with the future we want. I thought that was good advice.
Yeah.
Circling back to the bureaucrats, you know, I asked him, what's the biggest hurdle that's keeping us from becoming a sustainable society? And I just loved his answer when he said that the biggest hurdle is we don't ask ourselves what the biggest hurdle is. So I felt proud of myself for asking. And then this is also related to the success too, and that he has this theory that people in power don't equate solving this problem with their success. So he said, we lack this sense of having skin in the game. And I think that's kind of the short-termism. That is that, you know, you have to run for re-election in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years, as the case may be, depending on what office you hold. And, you know, you're too focused on that. You have to deliver better lives next year, not a livable, hospitable, survivable, wonderful planet in 25 years or 50 years.
Right.
Another thing on my list of major takeaways is that the way I would put it is that we misdiagnose and we misinterpret. Nobody ever dies from overshoot. Instead, they die from its symptoms: economic breakdowns, poverty, wars, pandemics, natural disasters, heat waves, that kind of stuff. And so we end up focusing on all those symptoms and missing the underlying root cause, which is overshoot.
Right. And it doesn't all happen at one time. That's another thing to think about, is it sort of happens gradually. So if you're not paying attention and you just kind of think it is part of life and it's part of the circle of life that we're all supposed to experience these things, then you're probably not going to do anything about it.
And then another interesting takeaway for me was that Matis told us that we're under preparing people today for what is to come. And I think he was talking about the educational system, but probably in general as well. I think that just kind of connects to the denial. We're trying to kind of correct that with the Growth Busters podcast. We're trying to prepare people for what is to come. but there are so many things stopping us. We've pretty well run down a shopping list of reasons why we aren't preparing people for what is to come. And valuable, this is another little gem that I think we don't want to lose track of, and that is that he thinks it's important how fast we get back into sustainable balance. He pointed out that if we take a long time to get back into sustainable balance, then we won't have very much biocapacity left to work with, because we will have diminished the Earth's biocapacity. We're damaging it right now. That's how we're managing to live in overshoot. We're borrowing from the planet's future capacity in order to support our level of overshoot today. So if it takes us a long time to fix that, then we have a crippled planet to work with. If we can get back into balance more quickly, then we've got a bigger budget of biocapacity. We have a healthier planet, and we can have better lives sooner. Better living through chemistry.
Yeah. And I think just sort of like adding to that, as we continue to borrow from other nations and, you know, all of our social dumping and everything that we do is just sort of breeding all of these injustices to these other countries that are experiencing these effects firsthand. We're not, and we should be setting that example. We are privileged in a way that a lot of these nations just are not. Just historically, we are privileged in just environmentally being where we're at. We have had that privilege and we should know how to use that, but we don't. We're breeding injustices.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, once you dig into all of the great data at the websites that we're going to give you links to in the show notes, of course, you'll discover, as you suspect, that the people in the overdeveloped world, our ecological footprint, you know, is massive. You know, we are the worst offenders, obviously. The United States, I know a year ago, the data suggested that if everyone on the planet lived like the average North American does, that we would need five Earths, that we're five times into overshoot. We're probably a little bit more than that this year. So we're doing way more than our share of damage. And a lot of people who have good hearts like to point out that the people who are living on the margin are really going to suffer. But, you know, we're going to suffer.
Did you happen to measure your carbon footprint or your ecological footprint?
I did. And that's one of the most important links that we've got in the show notes for you is a footprint calculator. And there are a few of them out there. And we're giving you the link to the calculator that the Global Footprint Network has designed, because we just happen to have a lot of respect for the work that the Global Footprint Network is doing. So I think I put it off and I put it off. I hadn't done it in a few years, but I knew for this conversation, Erica, that I was going to need to be able to report to you how poorly I did.
Same.
So you did it?
I did do it. Yeah. Yep.
How did you feel as you went through it? What were you thinking and feeling?
Well, I've already made the decision to never bring life into the planet. So I kind of went in a little, feeling a little slightly arrogant about my footprint. I thought, well, I'm going to have the best one out there. Uh-huh. There's nothing more that I can do. But that's not true. I also do enjoy, you know, hot wings and burgers every now and then. And if everybody lived the way that I lived, we would need, oh, I don't know if I want to say it out loud.
I'm betting that you're going to look better than I do.
3.4 Earths.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, it's so gross.
I got you beat just barely. Yeah. I'm at 3.3. I'm at 3.3 Earths. But in all fairness, the calculator doesn't ask you how many children you've conceived or whether you're planning to raise children.
Right.
So it's not giving you credit. We really need to ask Matas about that. That's probably really complicated to figure out a way to build that into this calculator, because that's huge.
It's huge. It's everything.
Yeah, you bring another life into this world. You've got to take a significant amount of responsibility for that footprint, and especially if that life then brings another life or a couple of lives into the world. You know, you've kind of started a chain reaction. We've talked about it in other episodes, but they're our scientists who try to come up with the best approximation of how to give you credit for making the total ecological footprint of human civilization bigger. I mean, that's a whole person. one person can only do so much to slim up their life and reduce their footprint. You're still a person. You still have needs for shelter, transportation, food, and all those things. But I think what killed me was probably the air travel. I'm trying to do less and less of it, but I can't brag like some people can and say I've given it up completely. I haven't yet done that.
But you travel with a mission, you know?
You can forgive me a little bit for that. But I've been on an airplane for one vacation this year, reluctantly, guiltily. And every now and then there are family needs that put you on an airplane. The other thing that killed me, I think, was, and I think a little bit unfairly, was the size of the house that I live in. And you probably fared really well in that department. Congratulations to you, Erica. My problem, and I agonize over this a lot, but I married into a huge house. And in fact, I'm embarrassed when people who I know are really into sustainable living, when they come over here, I'm embarrassed. I feel like I have to explain what's going on here. Over the 7.5 years that I've been in this marriage, I've been trying to gently get us into the mode where we might be ready to downsize. But I reached an interesting point just last week where I'm not going to feel as guilty about it as I used to. And that is because we make very good use of the space in some ways. Like we've created this podcasting studio and we make that available to a lot of people who are doing podcasts about good subjects. It's also been the film studio where we've filmed some really cool and useful YouTube videos for the Growth Busters YouTube channel. It's our editing suite as well. And we do not air condition the house. We do not have an air conditioner, and we heat very little of the house. And I was thinking, if I were to convince my wife tomorrow that we should downsize, move out, the family that moves into this house, the first thing they're going to do is put in air conditioning. So by staying here in place, we are keeping this house from being air conditioned. So I think that's a good thing.
I agree.
Yeah. So I think I got unfairly dinged a little bit for living in an above average size house. So sue me. I'm confessing right here.
They say,
I'm not living in a tiny house.
It's okay. They do say a happy wife is a happy life, right?
Yeah. If you're in a relationship, I mean, you got to decide, you know, how principled are you? Are you going to tell somebody, you know what? I can't date you. I cannot marry you because you are not trying to save the planet. So I really want to recommend to everyone that they do the calculator. And I think its real value is pay attention to the questions and your answers. And I think it can help give you some ideas for what you might want to try to do to be a better citizen of planet Earth. You might come up with a goal.
Yeah.
Something you want to do so that you want to take this test, calculate your ecological footprint again in 2 months or 6 months or a year, and be determined for it to be smaller when you do that.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun when you look at it that way, right? People like to measure all sorts of things, their steps, their calories. Oh, why not measure your footprint? Yeah. That's actually good for everybody.
Yeah. Circling back, I really want to just pat you on the back and thank you for the last question you asked. And that was, you asked about the role of population in ecological footprint and overshoot. And I think it opened the door for Matis to give a really elegant answer, a really smart answer, I thought.
Yeah. I'm really glad I asked that question too. Before he left, I was like, whoa, one more question. You guys all probably know I am interested in like social mechanisms that are behind reproductive decision making. And as much as we like to talk about one child less and family ethics, it's easy to talk about it. It's even easy for people to agree with you as you're talking about this. Well, having one child less could actually be a really great positive thing for not just our family and not just our budget, but for the planet as a whole. But it's not so easy to actually do, which is why I'm very interested in studying those social factors involved and kind of demystifying this assumption that we're all supposed to have as many children as we want. I never believed that to be true, and I very much today do not. So it was really important for me to ask that last question. And it's sort of the aspect of overshoot that gets overlooked. more often than not, which is really upsetting. So I'm glad that he did answer. And just as a reminder, it'd be just recommended that we adopt a fertility rate of some of these other countries like Spain or Portugal instead of what we are currently doing.
Yeah. So there, to those journalists out there who are busy writing stories today about the fact that we've got to cut our beef consumption in half so that we can feed 10.9 billion people, Matthias Wackernagel just gave you another solution. You know, we could have world population be 4 billion instead of 11 billion.
Right.
How about that?
Burgers for everyone.
Yeah. Might still want to cut back on the burgers. A little bit anyway. I really wanted to discuss this with him, and I really want to discuss it with you, but I really think we need to maybe make an appointment to do this on another episode, Erica. But I really want to explore at some point, what is fair for somebody's ecological footprint? If I want to be a moral person who's got a really good true north on my moral compass, do I need to make sure that my ecological footprint is at or below the average per person biocapacity of the entire planet, or at or below the average per person biocapacity of my country? Do we have an obligation to be living within our means in the nation that we just got lucky enough to be born in? Or do we have an obligation to not be using any more than, you know, dividing the whole biocapacity of the planet today by 7.7 billion people? Is that really what your biocapacity budget should be? Wackernagel has co-written this new book, Ecological Footprint, Managing Our Biocapacity Budget, that will be published on September 3rd of 2019. So as we have this discussion and publish this podcast, it is not yet available to have in your hot little hands, although you can go ahead and pre-order it now if you want. So look for the link in the show notes for that. So here we are with a world record length Growth Busters podcast already, and we're not going to go on for much longer at all, mainly because we're going to devote another entire episode to this subject. This is our treat for you, a special gift. We thought that Overshoot was an important enough subject, the subject of the century, really, that we produced a one-hour radio special about it. It's called Welcome to Overshoot, Have a Nice Day. And it's part of this Conversation Earth radio series that I produced and hosted a couple of years ago. I haven't been creating any new episodes in 2 years because there weren't enough hours in the day, and there certainly wasn't enough money in the budget to hire the staff that would be needed in order for us to crank out a new episode every week. We just couldn't do it. So we sort of put that into idle, but promised that we would produce a special every now and then. And so we did. We completed this one-hour special called Welcome to Overshoot, Have a Nice Day. Hopefully some radio stations have already got that into their program schedule for the week leading up to Earth Overshoot Day. But we're going to make that available to you as just a bonus episode of the Growth Busters podcast. So right after we publish this great interview with Matthias Wackernagel and insightful commentary by Erica and Dave, we will turn around and we'll publish this Conversation Earth special as a bonus episode of Growth Busters. And I think you'll find it interesting. And it could be if there was one episode, just one out of the dozens of episodes that we've produced already, that you were going to give to your graduating high school senior or to your best friend or to your mayor or to the next president of the United States or the next prime minister of the Great Britain, or, you know, just about anybody. I mean, that would be it. It could be the most important podcast episode ever made, couldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Am I being a little cocky there?
Not at all. I'm definitely looking forward to sharing the book. I plan on getting a copy pre-ordered very soon. We want to share a link of where we can pre-order the book as well.
Yep. Go to the show notes for that.
Excellent.
So just kind of to wrap up this episode, you know, I think the big question is, and I'm stealing these words, I think, straight from the book, will this process simply continue, or will we manage to reverse the trend? It's a gigantic challenge. And the answer is going to be in how we build cities, how we power ourselves, how we feed ourselves, and how many of us there are. All these aspects of our behavior, that's all going to determine whether we just continue sliding deeper and deeper into Overshoot or whether we find a way to reverse that trajectory.
Yeah. So start the conversation, write to us if you have any questions about it. We're always happy to hear from our listeners and always happy to support you in starting the conversation and moving forward.
So be sure to check the show notes for important links. Go to that calculator and figure out what your carbon footprint is. Let us know what it is, what thought that gave you. And it's not New Year's, but there's no time like the present to adopt some kind of a resolution to skinny up your life a little bit and shrink your footprint. We'd love to hear about your adventures in embracing the joy of sustainable living. Head over to growthbusters.org to explore these issues more deeply. And I really want to encourage you to subscribe to the Growth Busters podcast if you haven't already. It doesn't cost you any money. And that way you won't miss an episode. And then, finally, Erica, let me do one more great quote from this book, this new book coming out September 3rd. These are the last words out of my mouth for this episode. The number one rule for the scenarios is one planet living. As far as we know, there is only this one planet in human reach able to produce chocolate. Let's make the most of it. Life is meant to be wonderful, and all human beings ought to have a chance to thrive and live with dignity on this earth.
Amen.
Some may dream to paint mountains and streams, but not me. I'm a growth buster. Some may just want more, but don't know what it's for, but not me. I'm a growth buster. Don't want a solution at the cost of pollution. They think bigger is better at the cost of the weather. But no, not us. We are the growth busters. Calling, 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 calling. Call the growth busters.